Hi, everybody. Welcome to Book Tales with Rand Dugat and Heather Fowler. Today, we are delighted to feature Margot Duahi, author of Scorched Grace, published by Gillian Flynn Books.
Book Tales, Readings, Cocktails, and Craft
is a monthly podcast series with live author readings, custom cocktails, and discussions on the craft of writing. Why cocktails? We thought that having a cocktail while listening to your favorite author chat and give a reading would be a fun idea. Today, we are drinking the Convent Maker, reminiscent of a Boilermaker, which is referenced in Margot's story. The recipe is on the Hot Redhead Media blog link in the podcast description if you'd like to make it and have one with us.
Margot Duahi lives and works in Northampton, Massachusetts. She earned a BA in writing from the University of Pittsburgh and a PhD in creative writing from Lancaster University. She is the author of the lyrical crime novel Scorched Grace, which was named a New York Times Book Review Editor's Choice, a Best Book of 2023 by Marie Claire, Apple Books, Barnes & Noble, and BookPage, as well as being heralded as one of the most anticipated crime books of the year by Crime Reads, Them, and LGBTQ Reads. She is also the author of the poetry collections Bandit Queen, The Runaway Story of Belle Starr, Scranton Lace, Girls Like You, and I Would Ruby If I Could, a co-editor of the Cambridge University Press Elements in Crime Narrative Series, and multimodal multimedia section editor of Journal of Creative Writing Studies. Duahi's work has been featured in the Adirondack Review, American Micro Reviews and Interviews, and others. Of Scorched Grace, the book we feature today, author Elizabeth Hand says it is a, quote, searing journey through faith, fire, and female rage, end quote. Love it. Great praise.
When St. Sebastian's School becomes the target of a shocking arson spree, the Sisters of the Sublime Blood and their surrounding New Orleans community are thrust into chaos. Patience is a virtue, but punk rocker turned nun Sister Holiday isn't satisfied to just wait around for officials to return her home and sanctuary to its former peace, instead deciding to unveil the mysterious attacker herself. Her investigation leads her down a twisty path of suspicion and secrets, turning her against colleagues, students, and even fellow sisters along the way. And to piece together the clues of this high-stakes mystery, she must at last reckon with the sins of her own past. An exciting start to a bold series that breathes new life into the hard-boiled genre. Scorched Grace is a fast-paced and punchy whodunit that will keep readers guessing until the very end.
How are you doing today, Margot?
I am just so delighted. I'm ecstatic to speak with you too. It's never going to lose its luster in talking about what I love, which is art, books, writing them, reading them, and the fact that you build community in such a way. You're celebrating with book tales and storytelling. It's just such a joy. So I'm thrilled to be here.
We're excited and looking forward to chatting with you about your work, but also having you give us a little reading later. Do you enjoy giving live readings?
I really do. It's a way to share what's inside my head with you in a different way. And sometimes it's so interesting to hear a voice as you're reading a book or even listening to a narrator read an audiobook, and then hear the author read. It's just a tapestry of interpretation and intimacy. I just love being a part of it. So yeah, I love reading.
Well, that's awesome. As you mentioned earlier, Heather, Scorched Grace is a Gillian Flynn imprint. And Margot, I was wondering if you could share with us how that happened, a little bit about the process of collaborating with them and what it was like to work with Flynn.
Once I come down from the astral plane, I will definitely let you know. But it's just one of those divine timing meets good luck meets 20 years of work and obsession and kind of not giving up despite all of my attempts and threats to give up, where I had the really great fortune of locating an agent who wanted to take some creative swings with me and work in genre in a way that felt different and took some big risks in terms of style and playing with tropes in the genre, as well as reimagining them and reimagining what they could be. And we worked pretty hard on a revision during the pandemic. And then when my agent, Laura McDougall, is wonderful and brilliant and candid, she always tells you what she's thinking, which I so appreciate. She put the book out on submission at a time when the incredible Gillian Flynn announced that she was going to start her own publishing imprint with an independent publisher called Zando, based in New York City. And they partner with cultural innovators, tastemakers, icons, influencers. So Gillian Flynn has her own imprint called Gillian Flynn Books. Sarah Jessica Parker has her own imprint with Zando called SJP Lit. John Legend has an imprint. It's a remarkable organization. And through the unbelievable good luck and good timing, the manuscript was put in front of Gillian and she said she loved it and signed me as her first author. So her debut author, which is still so unbelievably extraordinary and wonderful and just surreal. So she has been an icon of mine for the past more than decade, ever since I read Sharp Objects, which recalibrated my brain and what is possible in terms of mystery storytelling. Of course, Gone Girl. She's just been a huge source of inspiration for me, and she gives me a lot of runway to play and to create work with meaning and with rigor and with heart and work that really makes a claim, plants a flag in a particular territory or space. And she really does like to take risks and put out weird books.
It sounds like an amazing experience.
It's been incredible. And I have another book in the series coming out with her in March, which will be exciting to celebrate at the Tennessee Williams Festival 2024. And so just the fact that we can continue to work together in this series and explore arcs that are broad across the series. And for any mystery lovers that are listening right now, that kind of joy of following a sleuth or an investigator through the narrative world of one book. And then, of course, the series itself offers another layer of mystery. So I'm really just so fortunate that I can work in that cartography as well as each individual book.
Yeah.
Sounds like such an amazing positioning and congruence of people and things coming together at the right time. That's great. I had just been about to ask you a question about that. I had noticed that the second book already has an out date and is coming up. Can you tell us what inspired this work and the ones connected? Did you know it was going to be a sequence of novels? What drew you to writing about nuns and Catholicism? Any of that would be wonderful.
Yes, absolutely. I've always been a mystery lover and a fan first, so a reader and a watcher. PBS Mystery, Sunday Night, Poirot, Ms. Marple, Sherlock Holmes, anything that I could watch. And then, of course, I was reading, really tearing through the hard-boiled mysteries that were quite short that I discovered through really just my love of the kind of engineering puzzle, what goes into crafting a mystery that really can ensnare a reader or a watcher and just trying to understand the sleight of hand that goes into this. I love mysteries broadly, and then my real passion is in the hard-boiled space. So that lone wolf, swaggering, fisticuffs, wisecracking, hard drinking, adult, but yet of the world and, you know, outside of the world, that kind of figure that is really intriguing to me. And I wanted to take this trope in a different direction, but honor the lineage and that legacy. So I also grew up Catholic in the Maronite Catholic, which is it's a little bit like Roman Catholicism in that we're under the papal authority, but it's the Catholicism of Lebanon, Syria, Palestine region. And so the diaspora really is very connected to that. So my family growing up in Scranton, Pennsylvania, really connected to our heritage and religion, and they're really one and the same in a lot of ways. But I'm no longer a practicing Catholic in the sense where I don't really go to Mass on Sundays. There are a lot of reasons for it that are nuanced and complicated, but for the most part, I felt quite othered being a young queer kid during the time of kind of awakening and just really not feeling like I had a personal home in this house of worship. So I distanced myself, but it's always been there in my heart and in my head, and I see how much it means to my family. So in some ways, I thought my art could be a bridge between both my past and my future, where I make peace with these kind of unruly ideas. And this character of a nun just came to me. I went to Catholic school. Nuns were my teachers, and they were always somewhat mysterious to me. They didn't fit that angry or cold figures of lore or kind of nunsploitation, mass consciousness, the ways that I think those figures have been rendered. Nor were they the kind of zany, figures in a high camp expression like Sister Act, which I also loved. I just felt like me pulled to narrativize the inner life of a young nun, so 33 years old, someone who takes this move and a provisional vow with the Sisters of the Sublime Blood, which is an order I made up in New Orleans. Inspired by this amalgam of my own experience with the Sisters of the Immaculate Heart of Mary in Scranton, Pennsylvania, and the two convents that I would walk by in New Orleans, so the Ursuline Convent and the beautiful, glorious French Quarter.
It's such a pretty convent.
Gardens
are amazing. Yeah.
It's just, I mean, I just was there when I was back in March, and I'm just so arrested by the beauty and the space and the ways that worship are built into these spaces. And then there was another one, and of course I can't remember the name of it right now, but I would walk by it. It was near Ochsner, the space up on Britannia Street. I was thinking of them in my head, and then of course the lone wolf figure. I'm like, okay, I got it. I want a hard-boiled nun sleuth who chain smokes, she's bad attitude, but she's worshipful, she's devout, she genuinely believes in transubstantiation. I wanted to thread the needle. I wanted to explore the paradoxes and the dialectics that live in all of us, that we have this desire to be an individual, but we also want to be part of a community, and just really put that into a whodunit. And let the mystery and the characters drive the space, but also hold the frequency for lots of questions about faith and beliefs and love and sacrifice, and also exploring what queerness would be for a character who does take a provisional vow of celibacy. As a queer individual, we get to define and locate what queerness means for us, for all of us. And so this is another kind of extreme expression of that interest of mine. So there's a lot of information there, but
all good.
Yeah, very cool. But weirdly reminded me of the passage in the book where there's this gorgeous stained glass window and main characters looking through it at different angles to see different parts of the city in a very surreal lens. Mm-hmm. And I thought, that's what you're bringing me with all the different things you're bringing together, this surreal way to look at culture and religion and all of these other things too. I noticed on your webpage, which I thought was fascinating, that you were a member of both AWP, an active member, and the Radius of Arab American Writers. Can you tell us what you do with that organization? How does it work? What are you doing?
Yeah, absolutely. I love being part of a community. Writing and making art, really anything, can be somewhat isolating sometimes. And of course, I need quiet and I need deep focus. But the ability to share our journeys, our ups, our downs, our rejections, our wins, our triumphs, it's so important to help normalize and then also underscore how very vital art making is. For me, it almost feels like a compulsion, a need, an essence of who I am. But it is also work, and it's hard work. With the Radius of Arab American Writers, it's just so beautiful at conferences like AWP and little conferences throughout the country. We meet, they have a booth, we share stories about family or religion or identity, and it just creates a kind of cohesion with people that you might read their work, or you might want mentorship, or you might want advice or a blurb for your book. And similarly with the Sisters in Crime, feminist crime writing or intersectional crime writing, every subgenre you can imagine, from cozies to procedurals and the whole gamut. And again, just creating a space where we share workshops, lessons learned, gather together at big conferences like BoucherCon, which was just in San Diego. And it's a place where you can go and feel safe and feel empowered. So I'm a huge advocate for those groups as well.
I want to bring you back to New Orleans for a second. So I'm from New Orleans. I think that you write about the city so authentically in your novel. I know you spent some time here. You said, what is it about this place that really compelled you to decide to situate your story here? And what kind of research, other than walking around and looking at convents and just probably absorbing what was going on here, did you do for this book?
Ran from you. That means everything to me. Thank you. There are, I'm sure, tens of thousands of books that have New Orleans as a setting, and with good reason. And I thought, where could I set a series of a number of books? And New Orleans was just that place that felt so right, so fertile to explore the contours, the understory. And I researched quite a lot about the very strong faith of New Orleans, not just Catholic faith, but the variety of faith, the plurality of ways of worshiping that are so deep and so linked. So I spent a lot of time at the library, did a lot of workshops with some of the groups of New Orleans, including UNO and a tremendous writer named Constance Adler, who runs a New Orleans writing workshop group. She's just the best.
Yeah, I do know her. She is.
She is really fantastic and has been there for, I think, 20 years or so. But really just focusing on the kind of, I would say, the touch points of New Orleans and really creating both kind of history that I can use quite reliably in terms of relationships between some of the religious groups and, for example, the prisons and ways that particularly women religious have been quite progressive in a lot of ways, working towards social justice, finding the intersections between worship and service and anti-racism, prison abolition, for example. So that was really important to me to get right in the tone and also create a sense of the protagonist being an outsider, someone who is finding a new home and new footing in New Orleans was important to me as well. So just that, as you mentioned, Heather, the symbol of her looking through the window and through the various colors of the stained glass and then finding one translucent base, which is the eye of Mary.
I was like, that is nuanced and layered.
Yes.
I loved the fact that she was looking through the eye. That was making me happy in a number of
ways. Thank you. I wanted to give a lot of symbolic weight to ways of seeing and eyes and lenses, which also carries through with the next book, Blessed Water, in which the cover has her holding up a Polaroid camera to one eye and then the other eye is obscured.
That's so interesting. And this is connected because everything is connected in its own way when you're doing a lot of things that are close to your passion. I was thinking, okay, I noticed you're a co-editor of the Cambridge University Press Elements in Crime narrative series.
Yes.
How does that impact your view of crime genre or your work or service to the community, various communities?
Yes, I think the work with Cambridge is such an honor and it is such a gift because I get to take a different perspective on this genre that I love so much. So to look at decolonization in crime fiction and the ways that specific authors are exploring deep and profound questions about humanity, interpersonal relationships, power, powerlessness, agency, voice, trauma, state of the nation polemics, through these mysteries and crime stories that we love so much. And so looking at something that for many years was really considered more like lowbrow entertainment or on its own, but really giving it a scholarly home and saying, this is art that is worth our time as scholars and academics. But more than that, that we have a really broad ecosystem of people writing stories, readers who love them, and even ways that we can look at them as societal instruments. It's helped me as a writer because I get to see different strategies and the possibilities in storytelling and the different dynamism of critique that kind of can hold space in these stories without losing their propulsion. So I just find it endlessly fascinating. And I also love to just be on the other side of it too and see how things fit together from that sort of scholarly point of view, but always first and foremost being just a true fan.
Yeah. So
another way to express my fandom.
I always find the psychology of arson to be really fascinating. And for those who haven't read the book, there's a fire that happens pretty early on. And at some point you write this line, which I love, the fire's refusal, its ease, how closely our world is nailed and joined together, how quickly it can all ignite. When I think about arson in life and literature, I always return to Faulkner's barn burning. Mm-hmm. And I'm just always really intrigued with the way that he portrays it in that short story. Without giving anything away, can you talk a little bit about how the crime of the fire in the story resonates thematically, either for the novel as a whole or in connection with Sister Holliday?
Oh, absolutely. And that's such a beautiful way to intone Faulkner. That's fantastic. Thank you. I love being reminded of work that I love and want to just dive back into. The fire is everything for Sister Holliday. for Holiday Walsh and then for Sister Holiday. And there's just this pervasive threat and dare and promise of burning. And so there's, of course, the liturgical aspects of fire and brimstone and punishment of fire, but also the ecstasy of fire and the warmth of fire. So constantly toggling between these different aspects of what fire can give to people and give to society, and that menace and the threat that's there all the time. And so Sister Holiday is a character who is trying to understand her role in all of this and the role she has to play and what she needs to live a life of duty and of wholeness and integration. And fire is something that chases her, and yet she's drawn toward. So I've really wanted to narrativize that in ways that were very immediate and to throw the reader really right and face first into the sun in the book. And without giving it too much away, a lot of these choice points for characters, when something bad is happening, you can freeze. Almost like trauma response, you can go berserk or fight for her. She's a fighter. And so she really makes that, she almost is trying to fight the fire, which has other implications for her too. But yeah, the fire is just this kind of delicious and horrible element. And then there's the ways that the elemental and the liturgical blend. And then, of course, the erotic.
Fascinating. And we are very much looking forward to hearing you read an excerpt from Scorched Grace. But before we do that, let's have Ran tell us about today's cocktail, which she custom created for this book.
Today's booktail cocktail is called Convent Maker. And we're calling it that because, as I mentioned earlier, the convent features so prominently in this novel, and there's a reference to a boilermaker, so we thought it would make a really interesting drink. The recipe is on the blog if you'd like to make it and enjoy it while you listen at home. The ingredients are 2 ounces of whiskey, 1 ounce of grapefruit juice, 2 ounces of IPA. You put the whiskey and grapefruit juice in a shaker with ice and give it a shake. Strain it into a coupe glass and top with a little IPA. For the alcohol-free version, you can use zero-proof whiskey and beer, and it's equal. Delicious.
Okay. Margo, would you like to tell us a little bit about the passage you'll be reading for us today?
Absolutely. However, my mouth is watering about that cocktail.
Oh, good. And you'll have to have it later.
Yeah. Drinking it right now.
Oh, it's just so perfect. And the idea of the convent maker and just get thee to a nunnery, get thee to this drink right now.
Great. Tell us about the passage.
So this passage is early in the book, and I wanted to start with getting into the kind of cadence of Sister Holiday's inner life and how she brings all these disparate parts of herself into her vision, really, and how she's seeing and how she's narrating. Yeah, I'll just dive into her interior space here. Pain is evidence of growth. The ache means we're changing. And everyone is capable of change. Even me. But that doesn't mean I always got it right. Whenever I was punished, my task was to clean the massive stained glass windows of the church. I'd climb up on our rickety ladder and shine the glass, pane by intricate pane. 11 in total, bold blue, coral, fern green, and my favorite, sanguine, the color of sacred wine, the living red of a singing tongue during Vespers. Our stained glass told stories from the Old and New Testaments. Moses akimbo, parting the Cerulean Sea. The evangelists. Matthew is a winged man. Mark, a lion. Luke is a flying ox. And John, an eagle. The slow motion trauma of the stations of the cross. Adoring angels floating above the manger during the birth of Christ, our Lord. Holding luminous harps, like jewels, in their small hands. So beautiful, it hurt to look sometimes. Like watching people in church, as they kneel and pray, howl and lose balance. I see people at their absolute lowest. I hear people beg God and Mary and Jesus for second chances, one planet away from their spouses, or kids next to them in the pew, or so alone. They've thinned to ghosts. We're always there, us nuns, to witness, to hold space for miracles and the terror, in the boredom, in the wretched gore of life, to take it in, watch your hands tremble, validate your questions, honor your pain. You never see us seeing you. Nuns are slippery like that. With my special cloth, I wiped Jesus's crown of thorns and the doves of peace. The gilded vignettes reminded me of my tattoos, ink I was required to cover, even in the soupy heat of August, with black gloves and a black neckerchief, one of Sister Augustine's contingencies. Cleaning the windows was supposed to be my penance, and it was bone-tiring, but I liked the work. Each panel bewitched me. Better drama than Facebook or a bar fight. And during the first of countless castigations doled out by Sister Augustine, I discovered that if you pressed your face to Mary's face in the nativity glass, you could peer right through her translucent eye and see New Orleans shimmering below like a moth wing. On the highest rung of the ladder, my eye to Mary's eye, I saw Chapultepec Street in the hypnotic ribbon of the Mississippi River to the right. The city was electric at every hour. But at dawn, I was astonished by the wattage of color that vibrated in the silken light. Pink, yellow, persimmon-painted shotgun homes stretched out in the Garden District, long and narrow as train tracks. Purple and green Mardi Gras parade beads and gray Spanish moss dripped from the branches of gnarled oak trees. I watched the streetcar roll up and down St. Charles, passengers slowly climbing on in awe as the metal trolley bell pealed through the air. Most fools imagine New Orleans as just schlock and caricature, the tyranny of Bourbon Street, the green terror of Jell-O shots, throwing your guts up on the curb or into your crawfish etouffee. And yeah, I've rolled my eyes at that nonsense in the French Quarter. But the city is more complex and hauntingly subtle than I ever imagined, mythical and true, as true as any story can be. The intoxicating musk of sweet olive and night-blooming jasmine, cobblestones the size of Bibles, the terrible symmetry of storms, the eyes and rain bands of hurricanes, sudden downpours chainsawing the air, floods and rebirth. Across the city, I stumbled into random treasures, like divine visions, St. Anne's face in the palm trees. During my first week in the order, after picking up my uniform from the guild, I walked into a dusty curiosities shop that was painted in the velvet black of a Dutch still life painting that sold only bird skulls, scrimshaw, and marbles. I've never been able to find it again. Through Mary's portal, I watched Peacock roam the street with the technicolor hues of an LSD flashback, and I envied the freedom. I saw fog hover like a neon white veil over the river and the corner shop on Magazine Street, where Sister Therese learned you could buy one bar of soap and one vial of love potion for $5. She never brought the potion home, but her eyes sparkled every time she mentioned it. Sometimes, as the quiet desperation of my breath settled on the stained glass, I wanted to run outside, enjoying the spontaneous porch concerts that seemed to erupt at all hours. Washboard jazz, bebop, zydeco, funk, punk, classical, swing. I wanted to pull out a guitar right out of the musician's hands and play, to leave this earthly realm for a moment and let my fingers think for me, sweat dripping from my chin. But the order challenged me to stay, to soften the barbs of my mortal coil. Earth can be a heaven or a hell, depending on perspective. Control your thoughts, choose where to focus, and you can shift your reality.
Oh, that's a great place to stop. And what a fun excerpt. Thank you so much. And I'm so thrilled that the passage that I had mentioned earlier, we got to hear. How gracious.
Wow.
That. I hope more readers go engage with this book. We have a couple more questions for you. Do you have any new projects you can tell us about that you're working on, maybe concurrent with the series? Any new poetry collections or collaborative stuff? What do you have?
I love multimedia and multimodal storytelling, so I'm working on a virtual reality noir piece. I love noir. I love the ways we tell stories about characters giving in to their worst impulses and distrust and how we navigate that. And in virtual reality, I create these, they're almost like little flash fiction or sudden fiction stories as three-dimensional kinetic experiences that you can basically spin around, float around through, that kind of connect to that sense of disorientation as well as intrigue. And so they're little mysteries in a 360-degree space. So
that sounds so fun.
Yeah, they're really fun to create.
Where do people get these? Are they available anywhere? Where can they enjoy them?
Yeah, actually, one will be online with the National Center for Writing, which is a UK-based organization. Soon, there's a VR noir called Behind Glass, which I've created for them. And I'll be debuting one of the VR poetry projects I'm working on at the film festival, the Waverly Community Center in Pennsylvania in April 2024. But perhaps I'll bring one to the Tennessee Williams Festival.
Thank you. Absolutely should bring one. Interesting. Margo, what advice would you offer to new writers?
Follow your curiosities. The idea of the thing, and I know a number of creatives have talked about it, but we're passionate about so much. But I would say continue to follow what keeps almost asking you to come back to it. So the curiosities you want to chase down the alley and simply just never, ever give up. Take breaks from things, but always know that writing is rewriting and writing is a process.
Excellent advice. Thank you so much for spending time with us today. We really enjoy talking with you and hearing you read from your work.
Thank you so much. This has been such a gift.
It's been such a joy too. You're so fun to hear. Everybody, please order Margo's book, Scorched Grace, and the next one, and be sure to check out www.hotredheadmedia.com and subscribe to the blog for more information on the book tales, readings, and drinks. Subscribe to this podcast, which releases once a month, for more conversation with amazing authors. Thanks again for listening to Book Tales. See you next time.